You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALWFM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Once again tonight, I'm pleased to state that we return to a discussion of landlord-tenant law and what's new in landlord-tenant law in 2019. With me in the studio tonight, my guests, both landlord-tenant attorneys who have each been exceptionally generous with their support for both Your Legal Rights program and its monthly Call a Lawyer night. With me tonight are Sal Timpano and Jessica Chilek, both landlord-tenant attorneys practicing out of San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the local dialing area, our number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you may call regarding any question on the topic of landlord-tenant laws. You are not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. But before I turn to my guests, I'm pleased to announce that next week, for the first time in 2019, we return with our Call a Lawyer Night feature. If you wish assistance on any of the several topics we'll be taking up, whether on the air or off the air, we will have lawyers standing by to help. That's next week on Your Legal Rights. But back again to the here and now. Jessica, Sal, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Good to be back, Jeff.
Hey, before we go further, I'd like to start with this. What, if anything, is new for 2019?
Oh, there's a lot. Jessica, why don't you start?
Oh, all right. Well, there have been a number of changes to several statutes that pertain to landlord-tenant law, especially residential. The first one that is going to be important for residents and residential landlords and tenants is there was a change to the law governing the time for counting 3-day notices to pay rent or quit or 3-day notices to cure or quit. No longer can you count the weekends and holidays. So it used to be that a landlord could serve a 3-day notice on a Friday and they could count Saturday, Sunday, Monday as their 3 days, and that's not the case anymore. Saturday, Sunday, and legal holidays are not counted.
So, in effect, those notices now are expanding the time to cure or expanding the time for a tenant to prepare for the lawsuit that may be coming if the tenant's unable to cure, either because they simply can't cure or because it's an incurable notice. Those may be part of this as well. And so now tenants will have more time to cure the notices because they can seek assistance during the workday and not be cut off from those services because of weekends or holidays.
So in essence, what was a 3-day notice is now a 3-business-day notice.
I would call it a 3-business-day notice now.
With that, let me turn it to Norm in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hello?
Norm, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, I'm on the air. Okay, hi. My question was about in San Francisco, I know they've got rent control, but I was wondering what happens in a situation where the tenant is a what I think is called a it's a tenancy at will, where I thought that a tenancy at will could actually be ended by either the tenant or the landlord, and I don't know what kind of notice has to be given, but I was wondering if that still applies, because the person that I know that was the landlord was having trouble getting rid of the person that they were letting live basically in their home free. It was actually a grandmother and a grandson, and she just took him in one day, and because he got kicked out of his parents' house, and he stayed at grandma's house for about 6 years, and finally he started getting a little unruly, and she asked him to leave, and he wouldn't leave, and there was all kinds of trouble with that, and so...
So, Norm, as I understand it, you're not talking about somebody with a leasehold per se. You're talking about somebody taking in a boarder within the house, and you want to know what restrictions there are on those. Do you, either of you have a have an idea that of what norms looking to find out really what limits there are, what protections there are for a boarder within the house as opposed
to actually, the protection. I was curious about the protection for the person that's the landlord. I'm not even sure if they're a landlord, but they took the person in, and the person wasn't paying rent. It was her grandson, and he started getting mail there and all this, and then people were telling him, well, you're a tenant now, and she can't kick you out, and it just...
Norm, let me stop you there. Let me stop you there. I think I've got something to respond to your question. You mentioned tenancy at will.
Right.
In California, whether the occupant is a tenant or not, to get them out, you're probably going to need an eviction action if they don't leave voluntarily. You won't be able to just kick them out.
You know what? That's what happened. And I said, well, I don't know that much about the law, but I have heard that, you know, one of the types of tenancies is called a tenancy at will, and I think at common law, you either the landlord or the tenant can end that, but usually this stuff is controlled by statute, right? But I didn't know what the rule in California was. And then what happened was that they ended up in court, and the landlord did have to, she had to evict him. And then he lied and said he was paying rent, so it went to court. It was just, it was horrible. But really, just to make a long story short, I was just curious what the rule on tenancy at will is.
So in San Francisco, if the property's under rent control, the landlord can only remove a tenant with just cause. In the circumstance you described, with a roommate, sounded like this grandson was a roommate. Then
she just took him in and said, "You're my grandson. You can live here."
So the grandson in that scenario was at best a licensee there with the permission and consent of the owner, not a tenant, still entitled to an eviction action in order to be dispossessed, in order to be removed. So the landlord would still have to go to court to remove them.
Right, but on what ground?
That the license is revoked. It's much like a license to park your car in a parking lot. They give you, you know, the little ticket is a little license. You pay and you get to use the spot. Same thing for the grandson in that scenario. He's there by license or permission and consent.
Exactly.
Doesn't get any rights connected to that, and those can be withdrawn at any time, you know, unless there's some writing that says otherwise. But you're still, you know, the grandmother in this scenario is still going to have to go to court and get a judgment to remove the licensee from the property.
Well, yeah, that's actually what ended up happening because he lied and said that he was paying rent, and then it got pretty ugly, and he was willing to drag this out as long as he could because he really didn't have anywhere to go anyway.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I mean, most people that hear the story think this, it's her house. She didn't deed it to him. He's not the owner. He's there because she gave him permission to live there, and now she wants him to leave. And he wouldn't leave. I mean, he got in her face. He said, "Grandma, I'm going to live here rent-free till the day you die, and there's nothing you can do about it."
But you see, Norm, the thing is that because of the rent control laws in San Francisco, it's very complicated about when people can evict and when they can't, and so the sheriff's office won't do anything without a court order. So that's just the facts of living in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Norm,
okay. Well,
thank you for joining us. I hope that was of some help and that... we were able to answer your questions. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
And you as well. Bye-bye. We were talking a moment ago, and we have another call that's on its way through to us. But in the meantime, we were talking about what's new for 2019. You mentioned the example of the three-day notice, which went from three calendar days to three business days.
Essentially, yes.
What else? What are some other things that are new for 2019?
Well, now they've changed Civil Code Section 1947.3, and now a landlord must allow a tenant to pay rent through a third party, provided that third party agrees to sign basically an affirmation document that says that they are not a tenant and that the rent payment doesn't start a new tenancy. and that's probably for covering rent payment when somebody is sick or something like that, is how it's going to play out.
So it sounds to me, and either of you jump in if I have this wrong, but it sounds to me there was a red flag issue before. When the landlord starts taking payments from somebody else, who is this? Is the person living in the house? Am I going to get stuck with this person? And what this law has done, in essence, is gave the landlord an out where they can create a document saying, you know, I'm just paying the bill for this person. I'm not really a tenant. I'm not establishing a tenancy. And on that basis, the landlord has to accept it.
That's right. But the landlord does not have to accept it unless the person is willing to sign that document. If the person is not willing to sign that affirmation saying they're not a tenant and that they're not starting a tenancy with this payment, then the landlord doesn't have to accept the third-party payment. You know, and it works. I can see a scenario where it might work for, say, a subtenant whose master tenant is out of town or doesn't pay the rent or whatever, and a three-day notice comes in. That subtenant may make a one-time payment.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably going to work well for agencies that will pay rent for tenants where now there doesn't have to be a reason not to accept the money from the agency, because arguably the landlord could say, well, then the agency might claim to be a tenant. So now that removes that concern.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we're discussing landlord-tenant. With me tonight, longtime participants in the Call a Lawyer program and on Your Legal Rights, Jessica Chalik and Sal Timpano, both landlord-tenant attorneys out of San Francisco. Please feel free to call with any questions from our guests. It's not limited to where we are in tonight's conversation. Any landlord-tenant questions you have. The number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free. Our number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. So what else is new for this year? We talked about third-party payments, changing the status of three-day notices.
Well, there's also a new reason that a landlord is allowed to enter the unit other than in emergency situations. There was a change to health and safety code that landlords are now required to have decks, balconies, stairways, and walkways in buildings with three or more units properly inspected by 2025. And so that was added in as one of the authorized reasons to enter a unit, is to perform that inspection. And that would be under Civil Code Section 1954 on entries into the unit.
You know, we had a call from Norm a couple minutes ago that asked about subleases within a shared dwelling. As I understand it, in San Francisco, the sheriff isn't going to act unless he has a court order. So that really elevates the status of a person who's in essence a boarder rather than the tenant. What happens when you leave the city? Is that treated the same way, or is it really a distinction between a boarder in a house and somebody who actually leases a whole unit?
Well, even for properties in San Francisco that are out of rent control, you still need a court order to get the tenant or the boarder out of the house, because if they don't otherwise leave, the law does not allow you to employ self-help. So you can't move them physically yourself. You need a court order to do it. And that would be the same throughout California. You can't physically move somebody out of the house.
Well, there is a section I had it just a second ago. Civil Code Section 1946.5, which is the one that says that if an owner of a house or an owner of a single-family dwelling, whether it be a condo or a house or whatever, is renting to only one person, even if they're paying rent, they're a lodger, and they just have to give a 30-day notice. But that is really outside of San Francisco. You would have to check local rent control in Berkeley.
But if they don't leave at the end of the 30 days,
you still have to get
going to be a lawsuit.
You still have to get the court order.
You have to get a court order, yeah. So, you know, the landlords can do it, but the occupants may not comply, and then you're back in court with a court order, seeking a court order.
Ani's from Mountain View. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I have a question. I'm renting a single-family house in the city of Mountain View and had a fixed-term lease, yearly lease, and the term of the lease says it expires on a certain date unless extended by mutual agreement in writing or by operation of law. So I'm trying to find out, because we had a communication over email with the tenant on renewing the agreement for the next year, and they agreed to stay, and they asked me to shorten the lease. And then after a few months, I was surprised when I was given a 30-day notice to vacate, that they'll be leaving the house. So I'm trying to find out if electronic communication, like email, is considered legally binding. Because what they said, oh, you never sent us the paper contract and we never really signed it, so we don't have a lease and it goes month to month. Whereas my point is that we agree over the email, and my understanding is electronic communication is legally binding, so we indeed have it writing, because our term says it can be extended by mutual agreement in writing, and email is part of writing. So they vacated the house, they have left, the house stayed empty for a month before I could rent it out in the month of December, so which is not the best time for renting a single-family house. So I'm asking them to pay the rent for the house at least until I could rent it out. So I'm trying to find out my position.
So as I understand it, what you're really interested in is what constitutes good service if somebody wants to either vacate, or similarly, if the owner or landlord wants to evict, what constitutes good notice between the parties? Whether electronic communication is enough, or a phone call, or does it have to be in writing?
Yes, so my term of the tenancy said, the original lease that we signed, that it can be extended by mutual agreement in writing. And then my point is that since we talked over email and you agreed to renew the contract for next year and also asked for a change, like they wanted to make it shorter by 2 months, and I agreed to it, so we indeed have a renewal extension of the lease.
I can see your argument.
Email legally considered legally binding written communication.
Well, I can see your argument that an email where everybody agreed to the new terms would be legally binding. And basically, I think at this point, that would have to be something decided by a judge, because your tenants are going to say, no, operation of law makes it a month-to-month tenancy, and we gave you a month's notice to leave.
Mm-hmm. I'm also not clear if your original lease requires a signature, like an addendum. If it requires a writing,
I understand. No, if there was just use the standard PRBS, I think the California real estate form as a lease, and this is the term of tenancy for the fixed term lease. All it says is that it can be extended by mutual agreement in writing. So my point is, my assertion is that we over email we did agree, and that is in writing, to extend the lease or renew the terms of the lease.
Yeah, the only thing missing is a signature, right? That's it.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, well, I agree with Jessica that you're really going to have, yeah, I guess at this point it'll be a small claims court matter. It's going to be under the jurisdictional limit of small claims court, so that's where you would be. I see your argument, and I think I agree with it. I think I agree with your argument. I don't think you need a signature if your lease says an agreement in writing, because an email is a writing, and it reflects your agreement.
I think it may be helpful to keep all of the email exchanges, and the more that you can show that this is how you've been in communication in the past, and this is the way that you communicate between each other, it would only bolster your argument. It would only make that argument stronger.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Okay. But what, so is my understanding correct that email is considered legally binding written communication?
Well, it's a written communication. It is that. You're under your lease, you don't usually you have service requirements that are spelled out in the lease, but there are none for this. This is just an agreement in writing, and you have the agreement in writing. And the email even shows proof that you were communicating because it's back and forth.
Right.
So you don't need a ruling that it's legally binding. You just need to be in compliance with your lease terms, and I think you are.
Okay.
Anis, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Hope
right.
that was of some help.
Thank you.
Alice from Oakland, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a tenant in Oakland, and I have a question about rental increases, of which we've had a few big increases in the past 5 years. And for a long time, we rented, been renting the same place for, let's see, 2018. Been renting the same place for about 15, 16 years. So we've been here a long time. And about, let's see, 4 years ago, our rent went up $300 a month, which was a big increase for us. And then this past month, it went up again $250 a month. So basically, our rent has increased by $550, you know, a month. Well, anyway, you get the picture, I think. So my question is actually just I've always been sort of frustrated in not knowing the best place to go that's free to know exactly what the laws are pertaining to Oakland residents. I mean, and I did go to some government website, and I can't remember which one it was, a while back to see, and they had sort of a calculator thing on there. It's a single-family dwelling, so I think we're not protected the way that other tenants might be in Oakland. So I'm just wondering if there's like a, you know, a place that people can go who are tenants who don't have enough money to have a lawyer to sort of research the legal aspect of it and to find out if the increases are legal amounts just because they're...
Have you tried calling the Oakland Rent Board?
No, I have not.
Yeah, now they're going to be, you know, they're going to be, you know, an agency that applies their rent control rules to rent controlled units. You're outside of that, but they probably have some information that might be helpful to you. You're under California state law. No rent ordinance application, as far as I know. To the rent portion of your property. You may have eviction controls on your single-family home, but if you don't have rent control, then you're just under state law, and I think that's where you are. You're under state law for rent increases, which allows landlords to raise the rent to market value. You can still negotiate with your landlord, though. I mean, you know, you can, you know, you can still, you know, talk to them. If you've been there a long time, they probably – draw a lot of benefit from having you there. You're taking care of the property, and so they don't have to have an empty property. They don't have to go in and do a big remodel because you're taking care of it. And so, you know, I don't know if your rent is at market value right now or not, but you can certainly talk to them about it. You know, and
that was part of my question, because I also was about, is it legal to, you know, to quote market value as a reason, like a legitimate reason to increase the rent by such a lot?
Under California state law, there's no reason even required. They just raise a rent, you know, and the market will prevent, you know, the theory is that the market will prevent the landlord from going too high, because then they end up with a vacant unit.
Right.
So then, you know, the market has that type of control, you know, the invisible hand, so to speak.
Okay, so Oakland Rent Board, and then in terms of the laws, that's California state law. So then is there a place, I mean, sorry, I'm just sort of grasping. Is there a website or something where I can go to look up California laws about rent?
Jessica, do you know the code section for raising rent? I think it's 87 Civil Code 71.
Notice periods for rent increases is Civil Code Section 827.
827.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great.
And Alice, one other resource you have available to you from Oakland, you can speak to the Alameda County Bar Association. They have a lawyer referral service, which will provide you a low-cost attorney. You can get a consultation for somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 to $50 for a consultation, and perhaps that will lead you to either the answer you're looking for or potentially some help.
Yeah.
Their number is 510-893-7160. And they have attorneys that are on their panels that can be of some assistance to you. And I hope that provides you some relief and a solution. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call today.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Leslie from Novato. Welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So we have a coin-operated laundromat, so we're kind of a little different. We're a commercial rental. And we went month to month last year, and they kept the rent the same amount for the entire year. And we renegotiated a rent for this year in November, and she said, okay, fine, our landlord said fine, and told us what we owed. And then all of a sudden yesterday, she sends us an email backdated to January, which we've never received, and says, oh, you're going to owe we're increasing the rent. So I understand that since it's month to month, that they can increase it, but like, what's to stop them from increasing it every single month? Is that possible? Or I'm very now leery of staying in this lease.
Well, I mean, practically speaking, it would not make sense to increase it every month, but there's also notice periods even for commercial tenancies, so at best they could do it every other month, because you've got to get 30 days notice of the rent increase. So they couldn't do it every month, but even that, I understand at this point, it's a little bit aggravating to get this rent increase that you didn't expect, but it would be impractical for them to be sending you rent increases multiple times a year, like that.
And would our original, since we had an original lease that was, I think it was for 2 years, would any of those terms still be binding, or is that completely out the door now that we're month to month?
No, those terms are binding, except for the ones that are changed. So when you get a rent increase, that's a change to that original lease, and then that change becomes part of the lease.
So, but it's only a change to the rent term. All the other terms stay valid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Okay. I think that's it for me, so I can't really do anything, but thank you for your help. I appreciate it.
Leslie, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And Leslie, Alice, I don't know if you're still listening out there, but one additional resource that's come in is one place you can go for relief is the East Bay Community Law Center. That's the East Bay Community Law Center. It can give legal advice for low-income tenants. I don't know. I don't want to presume that you would qualify for that, but that is a resource available for you and for others in the area. I hope that's of some help. Kenneth from San Francisco, we'll be with you in just a moment. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back with you right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We're talking about landlord-tenant law. With me in the studio tonight, my guests are Sal Timpano and Jessica Chalik, both of San Francisco. Both are landlord-tenant attorneys. Both have been extraordinarily generous with their time, both for Your Legal Rights and for Call a Lawyer. And the Call a Lawyer program, of course, does resume next week. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. 4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, you can reach us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And Kenneth from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening. Thank you very much. A question for you about the ADA. I live in an SRO here in San Francisco, and I occupied my room for 20 years, and my wheelchair was parked in the hall. The fire marshal said it was a fire hazard, and I had to move it. My room was too small for the wheelchair, and the manager of the building, or the owner, I think it was the manager, got me another room in the same hotel with the same rent that is large enough for my wheelchair. But in moving me from one floor to the other, the landlord acted as if they were doing me a favor to move me. I believe that would be covered by the ADA, yes?
If you made a request for a reasonable accommodation, which was a place that would house your wheelchair, then the landlord would be required to look for a way to do that that doesn't add significant expense, very little expense, almost no expense. And it sounds like that's what they did. Your place is bigger, oh, and they're charging you the same amount of rent, so there is some expense there to the landlord, which they may not have been required to take on, but it sounds like they did.
Okay. Now, in moving me, I have a 3-page list now of things that have disappeared and or are broken. The other thing is, I believe they only half moved me in that all of my furniture is not back in the state that it was when I was in my original room. And I can't move the furniture. It's way too heavy for me. One thing I forgot to mention is this move initiated in October. And here we are at the end of January, and I still am not housed properly. What recourse might I have?
Well, you can make an additional reasonable, a request for additional reasonable accommodation for them to come and adjust your furniture. As far as your list of things that are missing or broken, you can come up with some dollar values and send them a letter making a claim for them, but you would have to be able to show that things were in the condition you said before the move. So if you had photographs, and sometimes in my own cases, I've used like photographs of birthday parties or people visiting where the item is in the background. So if you had that kind of information to show them that it was in good condition before the move and now it's not, then that would be useful.
And if your items are valued at the jurisdictional limit of $10,000 for a small claims court, that's where you would be presenting your claim for your damaged items.
Okay, now the thing is, some of these things have sentimental value to me and would have no value to anyone else. Does that mean that I'm completely up the river without a paddle?
Sort of. Sentimental value is not recognized by the law on normal things.
I mean, these are things that in my travels around the world over the last 35 years I've accumulated that had value to me, but I'm not going to go around the world 3 more times, or I don't have another 35 years to get these things back.
Yeah.
So I'm,
The law is going to assign market value to those. Sentimental value is not. I mean, you would certainly explain this to the judge, but the value of the items is going to be their market value. That's going to be the value.
You know, if you have certain irreplaceable items like family photographs from the early 1900s or something like that that have gone missing, you assign a value to them. You know, and then the question is whether that value is enough or too much or whatever.
Yeah, right. But it's not the money. It's the item itself that I'm interested in.
Sure, sure. And that's part of the problem because it's just too speculative. And so you've got that as an issue, as assigning value. And, you know, you assign the value you think is fair, and then, you know, you present your claim to the landlord, and if they reject it, then you use that as Exhibit A to your small claims action.
Okay, for the things, other things that are missing that can be purchased now, do I just assign the value that I seem to remember paying for it, or do I go to a store and look at the price for that item and present it?
I would look at the price. Your items were arguably used, but in order to replace it, if you can replace it, I would use the replacement price.
Yeah, for example, an alarm clock or something like that. You would go and look at what the replacement value is because that's what it's going to cost you to do.
Kenneth, one option you might look at is you might look online and see what you can find out there. It'll give you some direction of where you might have a larger place to shop in a single place than if you tried to go from store to store and try to find and recreate what you had.
Sure. If you do some online research at different, you know, like store websites for certain items, you know, that are easily replaceable, like alarm clocks, we'll go with that example. If you had, you know, Target and Walgreens and, you know, whatever else, mm-hmm. and a couple of different printouts, then that would be a good backup. And you know, since you're using a wheelchair, you wouldn't have to go out to the different stores.
That's right.
Okay, that part I understand. I have one more question, and that is for items that are broken. I don't know if I'm thinking of my computer and one of my stereos that don't work anymore. And I don't believe the stereo is made anymore, and the computer, I don't know how I could possibly prove that it worked beforehand, it doesn't work now.
That's proof is your burden. You're going to have to prove it, and you're probably correct in assuming that the landlord's going to say that the items were moved properly and carefully, and that your proof is not sufficient to show that they weren't broken before they moved them for you.
You know, if you had guests over who listened to the stereo before you moved, they might be able to help you out on that.
As a witness in court?
Possibly. Yeah. You can ask.
Similarly, if you sent emails through the computer or had communications or things that other people may have seen, whether it's at the other end of a communication through the computer or someone that was with you when you sent something or pulled something up or things that you've ordered online, perhaps and paid for, these are all things that could generate evidence for you that the computer was working before it was moved.
Yep, that would be helpful as well.
That part I can do. Okay, thank you so very much for your help. I greatly appreciate it.
Kenneth, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Good evening.
And Tony from San Rafael, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Can you guys hear me okay?
We hear you fine.
Okay, great. So my situation is I'm a tenant that I've been living in my place for over a year now, and so I share a retail space with a friend, and we do personal training, and there's a couple apartments attached. He was in the apartment. He actually has a lease for both the apartment and the retail space. He was moving with his family out of town, and he was going to have to shut down the retail space. So we decided instead of that, we'd keep it going, and I would move into the apartment. And the landlord doesn't know about this. And I, like I said, I've been up there over a year, paying rent kind of clandestinely. The landlord's pretty hands-off, but we've been talking about, you know, letting the landlord know that I'm there, letting him know the situation. And I've been a little hesitant. I'm not quite sure, you know, I guess I'd just like to check in about what my rights are before, you know, before moving forward with that.
And so where is this property located? Is it in San Francisco?
No, it's in Marin County.
Is there rent control in that county?
I don't think there is.
I don't believe so.
All right. Yes. What's your concern about letting the landlord know that you're now living there instead of the other? What's the concern?
I guess that my concern would be either that somehow that he either kicks me out or tries to jack up the rent. There might be nothing I can do about it.
Jessica, don't you agree that the landlord could do that to the original tenant before you anyway?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So there's really no incentive for the landlord to do that to you. The other thing is you have practically zero rights unless the landlord knows you're there.
Right.
Right now you're there without the landlord's knowledge or consent, so you really don't have any rights at all.
You said that you were paying rent sort of clandestinely. Does that mean you were paying with cash or with checks drawn on the account of the retail space?
Lately it's been money orders.
Okay.
Which are in handwriting, so I don't know if that makes any difference. And I have the receipts for them. But
I don't see any incentive for the landlord to treat you any differently than the original. Do you, Jessica? Do you see any reason here?
Well, I mean, you would have to have proof that the rent money orders were cashed, okay? Just the issuance of a cashier's check or a money order, having the stub for that just shows that it was issued. You would have to contact the agency that issued the money orders, whether it be the Postal Service or a corner store or wherever, Western Union, and get the canceled money order.
Well, I mean, we're assuming that they're cashed, right? Because the landlord's not sending any eviction notices. Is that true, Tony? You're assuming they're cashed?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I personally don't see any reason why the landlord would take any action against you. He might ask you to fill out an application, you know, a rental application to, you know, because you may not be telling him that you've been there for 6 months already. I don't know. That's up to you. You could tell him that. It would, you know, it doesn't matter. But, what you're trying to do is establish a relationship now.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it sounds like you're trying to do. Because going the way you're going, you have no rights whatsoever.
So he might consider you a squatter.
Sure. Because you're not his tenant. So I don't see. Do you, Jessica, see any reason where the landlord would try to take some kind of adverse action against him for taking over the prior tenancy? I don't.
Okay. I'm not off the top of my head, no.
I'm just guessing. I don't practice landlord-tenant, but it seems to me that when contacting the landlord, wouldn't Tony want to tell him, we worked the commercial space together, now that he's left, taken over and moved into the residential, and I'd like to keep this going and keep the relationship between us, but let him know that he was in on the commercial space with the other tenant, you know, throughout, so that the landlord knows he didn't just walk in off the street and start squatting.
Well, one of the statements that I recall he said was that there was a separate rental agreement for the apartment, and if that's the situation, I mean, they may be considered together, but if they have separate rental agreements, then it could be an issue.
Sure.
But the landlord knows you, right, Tony? They know you?
No, the landlord's never met me. No.
Not even in relationship to the commercial property?
Oh, no. No. So I've been a kind of a like I said, just helping, you know, working there and sharing rent, but I haven't been on the lease, so I haven't actually met the landlord.
Got it. Yeah. So it is a little touchy there. There's no magic way to do that because you're there. And in order to get you out, they've got to evict you. You know, I mean, you're not going to go out, you know, if you want to go out kicking and screaming, they definitely owe you that. You know, so you know what I mean? Why would they want to do that? You've been paying the rent. If you're a good tenant, they have no reason to do that. You know, they don't, you know, they know who they, especially if you tell them you've been there in the commercial space for a while.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of sort of have an idea what type of future they're going to have with you as opposed to somebody else brand new. So there's no reason for them to, you know, just no reason. Also, you could be introduced by the former tenant, perhaps. I don't know if that's certainly the way,
because I mean, the former tenant is still, you know, still also works out of the retail space, so out of commercial space. So that was the idea, is that you know.
And one last point, the former tenant could be in breach of his lease by not telling the landlord about you. There could be a breach there for that tenant. So it would probably be best to take a look at that lease, see if there's a requirement that he advise the landlord of a new occupant, and then just follow the lease. Maybe Jeff can give you a phone number where you can call out there in Marin to speak to an attorney about doing that.
That would probably be
a really good investment.
That would be the San Francisco Marin Lawyer Referral and Information Service, and their number
is 415-989-1616. Jessica is smiling because she remembers that for the last 20 years, call a lawyer night every month, I was the one who would walk up to the whiteboard and write all the phone numbers down for everybody. So I have these in my head. Tony, I hope that's of some help. And just as a personal notice, I don't practice landlord-tenant, but it seems to me if you notice something very small that's wrong with the place, or you think it needs touch-up painting or something, that is not what you want to bring up in the first call. You are there. You're not asking for anything. You just want to make contact and be supportive and keep the relationship going and be above board. And you are, you know, you want to make them want to have you there. So talking to them about the plumbing is probably not something you want to do up front.
Good old-fashioned sage advice.
Yes.
David, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Thanks so much.
Anna from San Francisco, welcome. You're on the air. You're on Your Legal Rights. Anna from San Francisco, are you still with us? David, I'm sorry. We seem to have our wires a little crossed. David, welcome. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, this is David in Berkeley. Thanks for taking my call. Big fan of the program. My question has to do with pets on rental property. Before I ask my question, though, I have to make a comment that I've made before, which is that the quality and volume of the audio feed when you're waiting to speak on the air leaves a lot to be desired. It's barely intelligible and very low volume. I really wish you guys would address that.
So you hear us on the air okay, but it's just the audio feed over the phone when you're waiting?
Yes, it's the audio feed over the phone that is very low volume and very spotty sound quality.
I will pass that along. Thank you for that.
Thank you. I live in a rent-controlled Berkeley apartment, and the terms of the lease have always included for many, many years for all tenants a prohibition against having any pets on the property. And recently, one of my neighbors in the building has acquired a pet, which they have documentation for as an emotional support animal. And apparently, the landlord cannot do anything about that, even though the person signed the lease. I'm wondering, is this strictly a Berkeley municipal ordinance, or is this covered under state law? If you have any information about that, I'd be very interested.
Actually, that is an Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm.
That
there has to be a reasonable accommodation of disability, and that has been extended beyond guide dogs and seeing eye dogs for the blind and certain well-trained animals to include emotional support animals. However, the landlord still has the right to require certain behaviors, like, you know, not having the dog eliminate on the property, or that the, you know, owner cleans up immediately, or that they're not barking all the time and things like that. So behavior restrictions are still allowed, but they do have to allow the animal on the property.
And then presumably the tenant would bear full financial responsibility for any damage or loss to the property caused by their pet.
That's right.
Just as they would if it was their guest or anybody else or themselves.
Right. And do you have any information about the kind of documentation that needs to be provided to support such such a claim?
Usually it is a letter from a medical provider or mental health care provider that says that the person is disabled and needs the emotional support animal. If it is a registered emotional support animal, oftentimes there is some documentation saying that it's gone through some basic obedience training and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So even though a tenant signs a lease that explicitly states no pets are allowed and then acquires a pet under this under the ADA, the landlord has no recourse even though the tenant signed a lease that explicitly prohibited pets.
In a nutshell, that's right. The ADA would trump that provision in the lease. Also, the animal may not even be considered a pet under the ADA, but more of a support or caregiver type status for that animal.
The ADA changes the animal's status from pet to more of a medical device, you know, equivalent to a cane or to a wheelchair or to something
that.
Like that.
Or a CPAP machine that perhaps the neighbors aren't really thrilled about.
Yeah, CPAP machines are loud.
Right.
David, I hope this is
some help.
Thank you
very much for the information.
And thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And now we'll turn it to Anna in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I am a senior who owns a house with a downstairs apartment, which over the years we have rented to friends at a very low rate, with the stipulation that if we had to move in, a parent or grandparent, that the person would be willing to move. And over the last 10 years at least, I have not rented out this apartment. I've let relatives and friends stay there. Now I'm going to move in a woman who is in need of a temporary place, and I am not going to charge her rent, but I do want to put that stipulation in place for myself in that I may, within the next 10 years, need to move to the apartment, which has no stairs. And I'm wondering if, with no paying no rent, she could still push back against that kind of stipulation.
So she's going to be a licensee, like we discussed a little bit earlier in the program, I think, and you're not charging her rent, so she's not going to be a tenant.
No, I'm not charging her rent. She's a relative of a friend of mine, and I'm fixing up the place, but I don't need the rent, and I do need somebody to be in the building.
Okay. If the person is doing any work, that may be considered rent, so you want to be careful about what they're going to be doing in the building. If you just want somebody, there's a companion, that's not going to be work, but you got to be really careful that, you know, they don't somehow offer you any caregiving services, which could then be considered rent. Then they become a tenant. Then your provision that, hey, you need to go when I ask you to go becomes null and void because you can't use that provision against a tenant.
The only thing that I would be asking is that if I'm away, that monitor whether anybody is moving around upstairs. If there's an intruder.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's... I mean, I would advise against even asking that, really, because I wouldn't... I would be very careful. And also, I suggest, and I think so would Jessica and Jeff, that you contact somebody at the San Francisco Bar Association and get a referral to help you drop that license, the license for them to stay there as licensees.
And again, their phone number for the lawyer referral service is 415-989-1616.
Okay.
We strongly recommend having this sort of thing in writing so that it's all clear at, you know, in the beginning, and that if there's any questions later, you have something to go back to.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add that it sounds like what you want to do is okay. It'll work for you, and you know, you just have them come in, as they're going to sign a license agreement to be there. You're going to say in that agreement, I'm not asking you for rent, nor are you ever going to pay rent. And, you know, if you think you've paid rent, you know, let me know right away because I'll return it back to you. I'm not accepting rent. You're here as a licensee. Like that.
What about sharing of utilities? Is that considered rent?
No, that wouldn't be considered rent. Do you have any opinion on that, Jessica?
I don't know. There's an argument there. I've had issues in the past where people have said, well, I didn't pay rent, but I've paid utilities, so I've made some payment toward being here.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ends up in court. And, you know, if that's what you're trying to avoid.
It would be safest not to take it, but you could include that in a license agreement. You know, the license agreement could specifically give a term to that, to those utility payments that are, you know, just for use. But it would be safer not to have it in there. I agree with Jessica on that. It would be safer not to have it in there.
Okay. I appreciate the advice. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Anna, thank you for joining us. Okay. Mandy, we're down to a few seconds to take your question, or if you would like to, we will finish your question off air. Mandy, are you still with us?
Oh, yes. Hi, I'm still here. We can finish it off air, I guess, because we're down to the last few minutes.
We're down for just the last moment or two, and I would really like to give my guests a chance to sum up if they would like. If you would stay on the line with us, we will take your call off the air as soon as we're off in just about 3 minutes.
Awesome. Thank you.
And I'd like to give each of you, Sal, Jessica, if you'd like a minute or so each to sum up, anything you want to add before we close out the show?
Just a reminder that, you know, 3-day notices to pay rent or quit and 3-day notices to cure some other breach of the rental agreement or quit have been changed from 3 calendar days to essentially 3 business days. And that landlords have to accept rent from third parties, provided those third parties are willing to sign a statement saying that they are not tenants and that the payment doesn't start a tenancy.
And Sal, would you like to sum up anything you'd like to tell us before we go? Take about a minute.
Sure. I'd like to thank the callers and everybody that's listening to the program. We enjoy providing information. Also, remind everybody that you can call your local rent ordinance boards or city halls and find out if there is any such department that can answer landlord-tenant questions, you know, in between programs.
And to that end, every county bar throughout the state offers, or will refer you to another close by one that offers, a lawyer referral service. They will give you a low-cost referral, give you a chance to talk to a lawyer for usually a half an hour for somewhere in the range of $30 to $50, depending on what county you're in. Those are available for you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight has been landlord-tenant law. My guests tonight have been landlord-tenant attorneys Sal Timpano and Jessica Chalik, both of San Francisco. Jessica, Sal, I'd like to thank you both for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. It's always fun to be here.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights, where we will also offer help to you through our Call a Lawyer feature, which returns next week for the first time this year. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. For production assistant Martin McLean and at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening. And again, have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.